Let me invite you to take your Bibles this morning and open them to Isaiah chapter 40. We want to look again in the chapter where we began this morning, Isaiah chapter 40. We are probably most familiar with the last verse in this chapter. Those who wait upon the Lord will renew their strength. They will soar on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint. This morning I want us to see this beautiful verse in the context of the entire chapter, chapter 40 of Isaiah. Because you see, this passage isn't so much talking about us and what we will be able to do as it is talking about God and what He is able to do. We all might think that the white-barked sycamore trees that we see along the banks of the streams here in the Ozarks are majestic and beautiful, and they are. But if you go to the redwood forests of California and see those towering giants of trees, it helps us with a comparison to understand that there are greater things out there. Here in chapter 40, Isaiah invites us to do some comparison shopping with our God, and he draws on a variety of comparisons and contrasts here in this chapter. Twice in the chapter, the question is asked. First in verse 18, with whom then will you compare God? We're going to see comparisons taking place. Then God asks the question again in verse 25, to whom will you compare me? I want us to consider four of the comparisons that we find here in chapter 40. Isaiah begins with a word of encouragement for preachers. In verse 9, he says, you who bring good news to Zion, go up on a high mountain, you who bring good news to Jerusalem. Lift up your voice with a shout. Lift it up. Do not be afraid. Say to the towns of Judah, here is your God. To all who would be heralders of the truth, proclaimers of God, he says, don't be hesitant, don't be shy. Stand up on the mountaintops and proclaim with all your might and say, here he is. Here is your God. Behold your God. I have been in the crowd on a few occasions when the president of our nation was the speaker. And there are few things that stir the blood of an American any more than the strains of that introductory song, Hail to the Chief. And when that music plays and then the speaker stands and says, ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States. It makes the hair stand on the back of your neck. And here Isaiah is doing that with God. And he's saying, ladies and gentlemen, the God of the universe. And then God is presented in these comparisons to those who would hear. And first he speaks of God in creation. Now we've all witnessed the power of water. Remember a couple of years ago when that reservoir burst above Elephant Rocks State Park and that water came down and took away so much of that park in an amazing display of power. We watched on our televisions as the tsunami hit the various beaches around the area of Indonesia a few years ago, and we saw whole towns swept away as waves came in from the sea. If you've ever been along the coastline during a storm and seen the power of the ocean, you know what I'm speaking of. But as powerful as these large bodies of water can be, as powerful as a flood unleashed can be, Isaiah states simply in verse 12a, the first part of verse 12, he asks the question, who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand? God is so great. We see the power of the oceans and the seas and the floods. And yet God, he says, holds all of that in the hollow of his hand. That's how great is the God that we serve. At the end of verse 12, he speaks of God's power regarding the land. He says there, who has held the dust of the earth in a basket, or weighed the mountains on the scales and the hills in a balance? Vicki has a measuring balance in our kitchen, and it's got a scoop on one end and then a series of little brass weights on the other. And she puts dry goods in the little metal basket and weighs out how much flour or sugar she needs and uses those balancing scales. And God is here depicted as weighing the mountains of the earth. The mighty Himalayas are on God's balancing scale. That's how trivial they are compared to Him in His strength and might. He's pictured as gathering the dust of this world, the Sahara Desert and the Mojave Desert and all those dusty, arid areas, and He puts them in a basket. So great is His power and strength. Not only the water and the land, but also the heavens. Look there in the middle of verse 12. He talks about with the breadth of His hand, He measures the heavens. And then later in verse 26, He says more of that. He says, lift up your eyes and look to the heavens. Who created all these? He who brings out the starry host one by one and calls them each by name. Because of His great power and mighty strength, not one of them is missing. You know, in the evening, the first star that you see is the evening star. And many of you probably grew up with that little rhyme, you know, as you saw that first star, I wish I may, I wish I might. And then the stars begin to appear as the sky grows darker. And one by one, God brings out our ability to see all the starry hosts in heaven, but we can't even begin to see the stars of heaven. Even the greatest telescopes devised by man cannot even begin to see all the stars of heaven. We cannot even begin to appreciate the breadth of our universe, and yet God measures it with the breadth of His hand, a hand's breadth from the thumb to the little finger. And God places that up in the sky of the universe, and that's how He measures this vast enormity that we can't even begin to see. Our sun is a star, and God is the one who brings out all the stars. Our sun is one of 100 billion stars just in our Milky Way galaxy. 100 billion stars in our galaxy. And then when you move beyond the Milky Way to other galaxies, there are over 100 billion galaxies that we know of in our universe. And each of them contain a comparable number of stars. 100 billion stars per universe and 100 billion our galaxy and 100 billion galaxies. So you multiply 100 billion times 100 billion, and that gives you an idea of the known number of stars that are out there in this vast universe. To help you understand, and this doesn't even help you understand, but to help you understand how we can quantify that, one astronomer has said that there are more stars in our universe than there are grains of sand on all the beaches of the planet Earth. That's how many stars there are. And yet God knows them by name. God has named every star. I think it's interesting. You've heard that commercial on the radio, haven't you? Where you can send in and they'll name a star after you or a loved one for a price. Whoever thought of that? Boy, they came up with a real gimmick. There are billions of stars. They'll never run out of that product. They're selling smoke, aren't they? They're having you name a star after some loved one. And so you can have a star out there and they'll give you its location. You can have it named after yourself or someone else. What they forget is those stars already have names. God is the one who has already given a name to every star in this universe. He knows them all intimately because He's the one who placed them, who flung them out there in the universe wherever they are. And then Isaiah talks about the knowledge of God. In verses 13 and 14, look what he says. Who can fathom the Spirit of the Lord, or instruct the Lord as His counselor? Whom did the Lord consult to enlighten Him? Who taught Him the right way? Who was it that taught him knowledge or showed him the path of understanding? Paul will ask that question later in the New Testament. Who is it that taught the Lord? You know, we've had some brilliant people in this world. We've had musically brilliant people like Beethoven and Mozart. We've had artists like Rembrandt, Michelangelo. We've had men like Einstein and Edison who we've dubbed creative geniuses. And yet God is omniscient. God is all-knowing. God never, like these creative geniuses we look at, never had to learn. He didn't go through an apprenticeship. He wasn't trained. God possessed all knowledge for all times. There is nothing that God ever acquired by way of knowledge. God was never taught or trained by anyone. He possessed all knowledge. See, for us, knowledge is an abstract thing. It's something that sits out there that we learn and we acquire. But God is the source of all knowledge in all fields of science and learning. God is the one who invented mathematics. God is the one who was the author of chemistry and all the sciences. God is the one who possessed music before man ever learned it, but before man ever discovered it. Now, God is incomparable when we look at even the greatest, most brilliant minds that humanity has ever produced. And then Isaiah compares God to the mighty nations and the rulers of this world. In verse 15, this is what he says. Surely the nations are like a drop in the bucket. You ever wonder where that expression came from? It comes from Isaiah. The nations are like a drop in a bucket. They are regarded as dust on the scales. He weighs the islands as though they were fine dust. In verse 23, he talks about all the world rulers and says, he brings princes to naught and reduces the rulers of the world to nothing. No sooner are they planted, no sooner are they sown, no sooner do they take root in the ground than he blows on them and they wither, and a whirlwind sweeps them away like chaff. You know, Rome was once the great empire of the ancient world. And they were the builder of amazing cities. But today, the ruins of that civilization are tourist attractions. We are awed by the power of presidents and prime ministers and dictators and generals. But none of them will last. God is the one who plants them. Hardly have they taken root than God breathes on them with a mighty wind, and like a whirlwind blows the chaff in the wind. Those great nations and great rulers are taken away. Now, I don't know how that affects you, but I take comfort in that. We have a God who is in control and who maintains control despite what we see around us. Political systems rise and political systems fall. Nations rise and nations fall. None of it's going to last. But God will last. He is the King of Kings. He is the Lord of Lords. He is the one who will reign ultimately and triumphantly in the end. And then Isaiah compares God to other gods. In verse 19, he depicts God as the true God against all the idols that man has created. He says in verse 18, with whom then will you compare God? To what image will you liken him? As for an idol, a metal worker casts it, and a goldsmith overlays it with gold and fashions silver chains for it. People too poor to present such an offering select wood that will not rot. They look for a skilled worker to set up an idol that will not topple. You know, it's interesting. They describe the gods of the nations around them, idols made by men. And there's an irony in all of this because we who serve Jehovah God serve a God who made man. Those who worship idols serve a God made by men. Is there not something faulty in that whole approach to a God? If you can make him with your own hands, then why serve a God like that? That's no God. He said, typically idols are made of precious metals, but when you're dealing with poor folk, they go out and they find some wood. He says, don't get wood, though, that rots. That would be an embarrassment for the face of your God to rot off in time. You can't have a God like that. Be sure that when you make this God, that he has a nice, secure, flat bottom so he won't topple over. Nail him down, glue him down, whatever you need to do, because that would be terrible for your God to topple over. And then he depicts the God whom we serve. In the last part of that section, beginning verse 21, he says, do you not know? Have you not heard? Has it not been told you from the beginning? Have you not understood since the earth was founded? He sits, our God sits enthroned above the circle of the earth, and its people are like grasshoppers. He stretches out the heavens like a canopy and spreads them out like a tent to live in. Our God is far beyond anything that we could touch or create with our own hands. He's above us. The heavens are his dwelling place above us. You know, it's interesting because the largest idol that was ever made in ancient times was the one that the Ephesians created to Diana. And that was housed in a magnificent temple. It was one of the seven wonders of the world. This massive, massive goddess of the Ephesians. And yet today, where is she? Yet today, who are her worshipers? They're non-existent. That huge goddess that once sat enthroned in the city of Ephesus is reduced to rubble. There's not a piece of her left. Instead, today, where that temple once was, if you visit Ephesus, there's a swamp there, and there are two old crumbly pillars that have been reconstructed from the ruins there, rising out of that swampland. That's all there is. Nothing more. No, God cannot even begin to be compared to the false gods that man has created. Now, all these comparisons are made here, describing the incomparable nature of our God. But the best part of all in chapter 40 to me are the bookends that are on either end of this description of God who can't be compared in all these different ways. As great as God is, as majestic and powerful and glorious as he is, he's depicted here in Isaiah 40 as a God who is approachable. A God who, as big as he is, who as vast as he is, cares about creatures like you and me. We might envision such a powerful God as one who is unapproachable in his might and glory. Yet Isaiah says, no, this incomparable God cares and loves each one of us. Look in verse 11. At the very beginning, before he begins making these comparisons, this is what he says. He tends his flock like a shepherd. He gathers the lambs in his arms and he carries them close to his heart. He gently leads those that have young. Isn't it amazing that this great God of the universe cares about the likes of us? And this wonderful picture of him gathering up those who are his and pressing them close to his heart and doing it with gentleness and love and kindness and concern. When you go to bed at night, I know sometimes you're worried, and I know sometimes you're frightened, but you just remember this verse, and you just imagine yourself as you are there under the covers with your pillow under your head. You just imagine the Lord of the universe cradling you in his arms, holding you close to his heart, and derive comfort from knowing that God cares for you. This powerful God who will watch after you and care for you and protect you cares for you in this fashion. And then he ends this section with the passage we started with, the familiar part of Isaiah chapter 40. In verse 29, it says, of God's response to us, he gives strength to the weary. It increases the power of the weak. How many of you here ever are weary? How many of you here ever are weak? You know what God will do for you? This is his promise. I'll give you strength when you're weary. And he says, I will increase your power when you're weak. And then he tells us the truth. We already know this through life's experience. Even youths grow tired and weary. And they do. And young men stumble and fall, and they do. But those, he says, who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. They will soar on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not faint. Let me tell you, there's only one category of people who will be able to keep on going and not give up and not fall by the wayside. And it's not young people who trust in the strength of their own bodies. It's those who trust in the hope and the power of a God who cannot be compared with anything else. Those are the ones who will soar with wings like the eagles. We, as His followers, derive our strength from the God who defies comparison. That's why Jesus was able to say, "Come unto me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest." He will give us the power to go on. That's why Jesus could say, "I have come that you may have life and have it abundantly." God alone can give us the strength we need to rise above the adversities of this life. There is no God like our God. No God at all. He is an awesome God, as we sang this morning. Great is our God. Great is our Savior. And great is our hope in Him. If this morning you need to place your trust anew in this God who defies comparison, I hope you'll do that. If you need for the first time to make your affirmation of faith in Jesus Christ and confess Him, turning from sins, if you need to go through those waters of baptism to begin your journey in Christ, we hope you'll make that decision too. We'll assist you as you make that decision. If you need to come this morning, we invite you to do so as we stand and as we sing.